Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I do present this information to you as the final report, the first presentation of what seems like a final report that should have been here by now, but we're very excited about the results that we have from this project, and hopefully that those of you involved in all segments of the industry can have something to take home from it. I want to start off by recognizing that I'm certainly a very small part of this project, and this is a collaborative project that goes across many universities and across many segments of our industry, and several of those people are here today. And when we get to the questions, Dr. Strobing said, we'll have them come up and be part of the question and answer session. But most of those people are very familiar to you, and all of us work very closely together to develop the results that you have. Certainly our industry assistants and the folks that were involved, Dr. Holm with MMI Genomics was a major contributor, as well as the folks of the NCBA staff that were highly involved. And finally, again, some very familiar names, the BIF, some former presidents and award winners on our steering committee, some very influential and I think people with a lot of vision that helped keep our feet to the fire in this project to make sure that results were presented in a format that producers in the industry were ready to take hold of and go forward. So I personally appreciate the efforts of all these people, and we couldn't have done it without any one of those people. This is a slide where I talk about beat demand and all those sort of things, and then when I saw John Houston in the room, I knew that I didn't have to spend much time on the slide. But everybody knows about the history of the beef industry, and everybody knows what's happened recently. Everybody knows the expectations consumers have for our product, that they pay a premium for our product because it is a premium product, and they have higher expectations, whether it's a steak or a roast or other product. Beef has high expectations, and to maintain our share of the business and increase that share, we need to continue to meet those very high expectations. So the goals of this project were, from a genetic standpoint, to address some of the issues that were very prevalent and hotly discussed in the period when this project was started. It's no coincidence this project was initiated in 1998. You've heard a great deal about 1998 in the last couple of days. That was the bottom of the beef demand curve. And that was a time when the industry was very focused and very, rightly so, concerned about what the future of the beef industry looked like. This was one of many ways that the industry decided to attack, from a genetic standpoint, some of the issues that we had with the quality and consistency of beef. Primary goals in this project, therefore, were to collect tenderness data. Many of you may know this as the Tenderness Project, although you'll see it's much more than just tenderness. To collect data that can be used for calculation and release of tenderness EPDs, and to investigate previously studied genetic markers that related to meat quality and also meat composition. And as I said, the project began in 1998. Funding began there and was recently completed. Just recently, so recent in fact that your proceedings article does not have the most recent statistical analysis. There's kind of that little disclaimer that says it will be coming later. Very proud to announce that the final report is now available. And as you exit this session and go to lunch, there's a table at the South Dakota Cattlemen Association booth with copies of the report. And I encourage you to pick up a copy. That we very much want to get this information in the hands of the industry. And hopefully there's useful information there. We knew we needed cooperation from the industry, specifically the breed associations. And all U.S. beef breed associations were invited to be a part of the project, and that they shared in the cost. You're well aware that a significant part of the cost were assumed by the dollar per head producer checkoff that each of us, contributes to. And this is another way that money is attacking some of the issues that we have in our industry. And the breed associations also shared significant costs, and I certainly don't want to downplay those because I appreciate the time, the effort, the blood, sweat, and tears, so to speak, of the participating breed associations. With no way could we have done it without them. These were the breeds that were involved, and the breed associations involved in the carcass merit study, and as you can see, that represents a majority of the germplasm in the U.S. beef industry. We were very pleased to get that many breeds to make that big a commitment of effort and cooperation to go forward with the project. The way the project was designed for the two objectives, to evaluate the genetic markers that had previously been discovered and to calculate tenderness EPDs, each breed made decisions about sires. Project allowed the breeds to choose the sires that they felt were most influential. Breeds, bulls that would have a legacy in their breeds. And those breed associations, I say in retrospect, did a very good job. Because there are bulls in the project that, even though now may not be the widely used, most widely used sires, many of them are the sires of the current most widely used sires. Some of them have tens of thousands of Fozzy recorded in their respective breed associations. Those sires were designated, the 10 sires per breed were DNA sires, the ones that we were doing the genetic marker work on. Those bulls, we sampled their DNA from semen samples, their progeny were sampled with blood to determine their DNA profile. Some of those sires, we also went to the additional effort of doing sensory panel work, taste panel work. That's a fairly costly process as well, so we weren't able to do that on all 10 DNA sires. But half the DNA sires, we went the extra step of securing an extra stake from their progeny so that a trained sensory panel could evaluate them for the typical sensory traits like tenderness, juiciness, and flavor. In addition, we knew that the solution had to be more than a 10-sire solution. And so each breed was allocated additional shear force measurements, additional sires that could be evaluated for tenderness EPDs. And the number of sires they were allowed was based on the registration. It's logical that larger breeds would be allowed to use more sires through the project. But those bulls, the target was to collect 25 progeny. There's no DNA work done on those, simply the shear force measurements on their progeny so that we could, on those bulls, calculate a tenderness EPD with a meaningful level of accuracy. The cattle that were the actual progeny that went through the project was, again, a responsibility of the breed associations. They know the cattle, they know where they're at. They have the cooperator herds in many cases that generated the progeny. Most of the progeny were generated on commercial ranches that have cooperative agreements with the breed associations. In some cases, when the bulls were selected, the breed associations already knew of large groups of those progeny of those bulls that were able to be fed into the project rather quickly. Everything about the way the cattle was handled was very much typical for the industry. This was not a university experiment station project, this was an industry project. The cattle were fed in commercial feedlots all over the country. We're harvested in commercial packing plants all over our country. Some key things that we did that you might not always do in a progeny test program, we did sample for DNA not only for the marker side of things, but also to ensure data quality. And that was surprisingly important later in the study. The associations made calls on management, days on feed, that sort of thing, but treated their contemporary groups uniformly, as you would do, and in general made very similar decisions across their entire breed groups. There were a number of contemporary groups within each breed, obviously, with the number of cattle that we're talking about. There were not multi-breed contemporary groups, and thus, as I'll tell you later, this is not a project to compare breeds. This is a project to compare within breeds, to determine the most desirable or maybe the most valuable genetics within each of those respective breeds. Cattle at the appropriate time were harvested in commercial packing facilities right beside the cattle that some of you own or contribute to the genetics of. These are the packers that we had contributions from. I've intentionally not updated the names. The names do change, of course. These are the names at the time the project started and the personnel that were involved in their cooperation. We greatly appreciate the cooperation of the packing industry. And most of the major packers and a large number of smaller packers were highly cooperative in terms of letting us come in and really change the way they do business. It's no small thing to come in and cut a steak or two off a carcass that they've got sold and merchandised. And we appreciate the cooperation of the packing industry. Once the cattle were harvested, we collected all the traditional carcass data in a very similar way a standard progeny test would, and then steaks were retrieved. One or two steaks off the rib of the carcass, a typical ribeye steak, and those steaks were shipped to K-State, to the Meese Laboratory under the direction of Dr. Michael Dykman, one of our team members, and Sally Strode is his technician. The steaks that were evaluated for shear force were aged to an industry standard 14 days, so we typically use an evaluation for tenderness, and that does make a big impact. Aging, we well know, is a major impact on tenderness. But all steaks were uniformly aged to exactly 14 days fresh and then sheared. And Sally was very cognizant of the fact that if we harvested cattle on Friday or Saturday, what that meant for her weekend. And so there was some coordination to do there, but we had to do that. We had to make the project as uniform and repeatable and consistent as possible. The sensory panel steaks were aged 14 days and then frozen. It's not practical to do taste panel on 200 head in one day. but those were all aged to exactly 14 days and then frozen, thawed, and cooked at the appropriate time. We sampled the bulls, of course, as they went into the project for semen for DNA. We sampled the cattle when they entered the feedlot, and then we finally sampled the carcasses. At the same time that the steaks were removed and that the carcasses were graded, we took a muscle sample off the neck of the carcass, the most inexpensive thing we could easily find, and ran DNA profile on that too, to ensure that the steak that we measured came from the calf that was bled and tagged, and that that calf originated from the sire that was he was supposed to in the original project. And there were some errors. Those of you that have put on your hard hat and hairnet and collected carcass data know how errors can occur in a commercial fact facility at the speed and chaos, as I call it, at least when I get involved in that sort of thing or used to get involved in that sort of thing. There were significant identity and paternity errors. To me, that's somewhat revealing, and as we think about collecting traditional carcass data and that sort of thing, that we were in this project were able to correct those errors because we had the information. In many cases, we could correct because it was a simple switch of animals. In some cases, we could not correct, that we had stakes that didn't match anybody. But that's, to me, somewhat something to think about as we go forward in carcass testing programs for more traditional carcass traits. I'll run through a few pictures for you. I know many of you are familiar with tenderness testing, but for those of you not, Dr. Dykeman provided these pictures. Here's a box of vacuum packaged steaks that had recently arrived from Meat's lab at K-State. They are identified there. They're vacuum packaged. They're identified with the tag. That's actually a plant ID, not the ear tag ID, but we have a matchup list for those. Here's a steak now that's been aged 14 days, and we're going to cook it. And we're going to cook it in a very precise way. We're going to cook it to exactly 160 degrees, I believe, Dr. Dykeman, to a medium degree of doneness. And so we have a thermocouple, a thermometer, if you will, inserted through the middle of the steak to ensure that that steak is cooked to exactly that degree of doneness, no more, no less, because you know what happens when you overcook or undercook a steak relative to tenderness. Another thing that's important as you analyze tenderness is to ensure that when we shear a core, that we shear consistently across the muscle fiber. You may not have ever really considered when a fresh steak that you threw on the grill or a steak that appeared on your plate about how the muscle fibers run. But the muscle fibers don't run the same every time. Sally has cut open that steak and exposed the fibers so that she can core parallel to those fibers. And so she's got, I'm sure there's a scientific name for it, it's a glorified drill press that's going to core that particular steak and take 8 cores, but those are run parallel to the muscle fiber so that when we shear the steaks, we shear across the muscle fiber consistently, perpendicular. Here's a steak that's had 8 cores taken. We take 8 cores on every steak, 4 from the medial end, 4 from the lateral end. We avoid any connective tissue, any of that sort of thing, so that we can get as a consistent and as repeatable an observation of tenderness as we can. Having said that, there is, surprising to me, considerable variation within every steak. It was eye-opening to me to see on 8 cores of a steak how much variation there is from core to core. That 1 core, 2 cores, 8 cores is definitely a necessity. This is the shear device, updated a little bit from Dr. Bratzler and Dr. Warner, but the concept is still very much the same, that at this particular point, here's a shear blade. This device measures the pounds of force required to push this blade through this core of cooked steak. And that's recorded. It's sort of like a fork wrench kind of a principle, but of course much more sophisticated than that. The core is placed there under the blade, and then its force is applied. The machine registers the amount of force, and the peak force required to shear through that steak is the observation that we use for that core. And we do that 8 times for every steak, for every animal. We also do taste panel work. Here's a cooked steak that's going to be fed to the sensory panel. Sally is squaring up the steak and cutting cubes. It never occurred to me until I presented these pictures that, yes, we do have purple lab gloves at K-State, along with everything else. But regardless, Sally is squaring up and cutting half-inch cubes, and those will be fed to a trained sensory panel. A trained sensory panel at K-State is composed of meat science faculty and some meat science graduate students. The training is more than you'd want to go through. I've been on sensory panels in graduate school, and I didn't him knocking on Dr. Dyckman's door, asking to be on the sensory panel. In fact, I shouldn't tell him. He might want me on there later now that he knows I have some experience there. It's no small feat to make the taste panel team, but there is very intense practicing, repetition. I know when I was in graduate school at Georgia and working with taste panels, they'd never had a smoker qualify for taste panel. Not that their taste buds were not good enough. We're not good enough to pick up flavors to qualify for taste panel. So this is not a trivial thing. The sensory panel is done in a highly repeatable, highly structured way. And of course, the panelists said, this is the kitchen side with those hoods. They sit on the other side at individual booths. The lights are red, so you can't even tell the color of what you're looking at. It's a fairly intense process. It's not just eating meat. Many of you think you'd like to be part of that. It's not as much fun as you think. I want to stress, at this point, project was designed to compare within breeds. And that there's always a tendency in the industry to want to compare breeds, and I understand that the genesis why we want to compare breeds, because that's an avenue for change, just as within breed selection is an avenue for change. But we need to recognize that this study was not designed to do that. That it is a very valid comparison, and everything was designed to compare within breeds, but that the cattle of one breed were not fed side by side with cattle of another breed. That each breed association made a number of choices about feedlot locations, about implant protocols, about diets, backgrounding, that sort of thing. They made decisions about cows mated to. You know, my hat's off to the Brahmin folks that were part of this project because they mated their Brahmin bulls to straight Brahmin cows because they wanted to identify the variation. They made a decision that I think identified variation, and I applaud them on that, and they'll have information they can certainly use. They have pedigree information on both sides of their data. But had they mated that breed to another, then that could change their average, certainly, potentially. And so we need to recognize that there shouldn't be any claims of breed superiority coming out of this study, I hope. I'm not aware of any to this date, and I hope that won't be a case. The average shear force, if the breed were to say that our average was this, that's as much about the management decisions and the mating decisions they made as it is about their breed's genetic composition. But within breed, where bulls were mated in like manner, and their progeny were managed in like manner, that's a very valid comparison. At conclusion, we were able to capture 7,200 shear force observations. And that's quite a few. Maybe not as many as we have initially hoped, but it's a lot of work for Sally and the carcass data collectors and all that sort of thing. A lot, 162 contemporary groups, I think, of cattle that came through the project over about a three-year period. Of those, 2,400 of them were evaluated by the trained sensory panel. Of the sires in the project, 70 generated enough progeny to be evaluated for the genetic markers. There are 70 bulls across the 14 breeds that were evaluated for the genetic markers. And among those had 2,500 progeny that were used in the marker analysis. Each sire, now that's, if you do a little quick math and say 14 breeds and 10 bulls per breed, that's not quite what we initially set up on. And we had somewhat less than what we expected, but you know the reasons why. You've AI. You know that every bull doesn't get the number of progeny that maybe you'd hope for. You've been in the plant. You know the things that can go wrong there. We were able to catch those problems, but I personally would have liked to see more sires completed, but that's practical. That's the way it works sometimes. But we did have a large sample of many breeds and were able to, I think, draw some very meaningful conclusions about the animals within those various breed populations. The overall carcass traits, the traditional carcass traits, things like carcass weight and ribeye area and those sort of things, very representative of the industry. The breed association personnel and working with their feedlot people did a good job of hitting the kind of targets that we're trying to hit. Average marbling score of like small 20. Carcass weight is 771, very typical ribeye area, fat thickness, that sort of thing. That's what you'd expect. What I did not expect was how high the shear force was in some cases. That I think prior to this study, there was a sort of a standard of 10 pounds that was often talked about in the industry, is that a shear force over 10 pounds was we thought to be objectionable in terms of shear force. Dr. Dyckman's taste panel actually didn't really object to steaks until they reached 11 pounds. And so we tend to use that number in this study. But still, it's alarming that a quarter of the steaks, a quarter of the cattle, were above 11 pounds, were objectionable in this study for tenderness. These are your best genetics, managed optimally, or what we believe is optimally, the same way they are every day of the year in Kansas and South Dakota and Texas and everywhere else. Okay. 20% of the sensory progeny were rated, this is my PC statement, I heard it from Dr. Dykeman, less than slightly tender. I think you know what less than slightly tender is. The next break is slightly tough. 20% were less than slightly tender. There were considerable amounts of variation within every breed. This next number, one of the things that Dr. Dykeman looked at is just the raw, this is not a genetic average, but just a phenotypic measurement average of every bull in the project. And then look within each breed to see how much spread there was for the average shear force of progeny of each of those bulls. And in some cases, there was some variation, about 2 pounds, from the best sire's progeny average to the toughest sire's progeny average. In some cases, it was more like close to 7. And as you go across the breeds, it gets even greater. But there was no breed that we could look at and say, there's no variation in this breed. Every breed had variation. And every breed has an opportunity to make change if that's so desired. One of the logical things to do, and of course leading to an EPD analysis, is calculation of genetic parameters, heritability estimates, genetic correlations, those sort of things. So that initial work was done by Jennifer Minnick under the direction of Dr. Doyle Wilson at Iowa State University, working with 4 of the individual breeds. I think the original breeds that she worked with were Angus, Hereford, Simmental, and Charolais, basically because those breeds had the most data early on that could be accessible. And then more recently, Dr. Coleman at Clay Center analyzed genetic parameters across the entire study, across all the breeds. And both their conclusions were that shear force is highly heritable, and that's nothing new. That most every study I've ever seen says that shear force is highly heritable, and truly most carcass traits are highly heritable. They can respond and will respond to direct selection. They are not highly influenced by heterosis. They are the result of individual gene effects that we control when we make mating decisions. Shear force is strongly correlated with sensory panel tenderness. Sometimes I almost get to talking about it in the same thing. But we have, when I say shear force, I mean mechanical, worn to Bradford shear force by the machine. When I say tenderness or sensory tenderness, I usually mean the taste panel, where they assign a score of 1 to 8 for tenderness. There's two things about that being strongly correlated. One thing is it tells us that the Warner Bradford shear is a good, repeatable measurement of tenderness, and that's nothing new. It tells us that if mechanical tenderness is certainly the easier and less expensive way to measure tenderness, not that it's inexpensive by any means, but it's cheaper than a taste panel, that is a good indicator of what the consumer will experience. So we can use that and maybe, for tenderness at least, not have to rely on frame panels and some of those sort of things. Now, a question that I often get is, how does marbling play into the equation of tenderness? And there's some disparity if you look across the scientific literature. In our study, that it was somewhat breed-dependent, a little bit, that some breeds had stronger relationships between marbling and tenderness. In some ways, it had to do with how much variation they had for marbling, how much variation they had for tenderness, that feeds into that genetic correlation. But in no case was it a strong correlation. It is favorable that there is a genetic tendency when selecting for marbling that tenderness does improve, and I'll say slightly, in a slight to moderate degree. But in no case did we see a very overwhelming relationship so that we could be assured that selection on marbling will cure issues that we have with tenderness. Now, one of the first objectives then, of course, of the study was to get in the hands of the industry SureForce EPD. Data that you could use in fire selection along with all the other things that we've talked about. One very small tool among many tools that can help you gauge your direction. Because basically this is an unknown trait. In some cases we may be very fortunate that we're not worse than we are because we've really not been able to gauge where the industry and where the breeds are going in terms of tenderness. And as of today, I'm aware of 4 breeds that have published tenderness EPD, or shear force, more correctly, EPD. Of course, the American Simmental Association that records the herd book of both Simmental and Simbra published those very early on. They collected a great deal of tenderness work on their own as well. Shear force work on independently of the project. Of course, the project data fed into that. When the project was completed for the Shorthorn breed, they published tenderness EPDs, or shear force EPDs, on 23 sires, I believe. And just this spring, the American Herpes Association has released tenderness EPDs on approximately 70 of the most widely used Hereford bulls that were in the project. Overall, there are 200 bulls among those four breed types that have published pentarden CPDs. All the breeds in the study have received data, and then it's up to them in terms of going forward to print that, if they want to analyze that and release that. And there's a lot of discussion about that. Quite frankly, I would like to see more breeds release pentarden CPD. I think all of us in the project would like to see that. I understand breed concerns about this being sort of a one snapshot in time. There are questions about how much further we can go with tenderness measurement, that we don't get as much cooperation perhaps with the packing industry as we used to with this project. I think originally the idea of this project was to come up with a prototype that everyone could just take and run. We'd do the first however many bowls, and then the ball would be rolling. I'm not sure the ball is rolling, but I do hear favorable things more recently. And maybe that's a function of market conditions, that when cattle are more scarce, maybe cooperation becomes easier at that end. I don't know. That's my personal theory and no one else's. But I would not totally give up on measuring tenderness on very important individuals. Now, a big part of this was to look at the marker data. You may be familiar with what's called the Angleton Project, a Chekhov-funded research project at Texas A&M University that, with the Brahman Angus back cross population, identified a number of candidate genes, QTLs, quantitative trait loci, that seem to be in that population responsible for some of the variation in many of the carcass traits, and I believe actually in production traits as well, although this being a Chekhov-funded study is restricted to product traits and not production traits. So the 11 QTL that were identified as having carcass impact were placed into this study. And the goal was to see, okay, it's fine that we see these candidate genes working in that research population, in a kind of unique research population. Are they working? Are they candidates for selection in the general American beef cattle population? Initially, as the sire completed their progeny, there was a rather crude analysis, a very simple analysis, sire by sire, answering the question, is this bull heterozygous? And those were reported. But more recently, there's been a powerhouse research effort that this big data set has drawn the attention and the cooperation and collaboration of people beyond even just this country. That we've had a group of scientists, Dr. Coleman has taken the lead, but we've had input not just from other members of the team, but other universities to really study and scrutinize. I think we've moved the science of analysis of genetic marker data along through this project. I'll give you a little bit of overview of this. You've heard some speakers in the last couple of days talk about marker selection. I'm not the first person to talk about that. Tallman, Nodder, Claus have addressed that, and so I don't want to plow that ground again, but yet my students tell me sometimes hearing it more than once is beneficial. I just want to point out the idea, this is slightly different than the commercial tests that might be marketed to you at this point, in that we're dealing with link markers that are probably a little bit further away from the actual gene compared to what's currently being marketed to you. And so in this case, we can't just wholly test every animal in the population and feel certain we'll get some kind of meaningful result. Rather, in this case, dealing with link markers, we've got a genetic sequence that is somewhere nearby what we believe to be a real gene, but not necessarily right on top of it. And through something called crossover recombination, those relationships change. What this slide is showing is here's four bulls, 1, 2, 3, and 4, that might have been in the project. And in a marker evaluation, what we're trying to determine is a sire heterozygous? And right now you're saying, I want homozygous. But in this type of a study, we can't identify homozygous. We can identify, at least initially, we have to start identifying heterozygous. Bull one up here is homozygous, and we've got a red allele and a blue allele. They're diploid organisms. They have two copies, just like they have two alleles for any color gene or horn gene or anything like that. So here's a bull that is homozygous red. I'm not going to necessarily say if red is good or bad, depending on if you're from Nebraska or Kentucky, I guess. You can make your call about which is the favorable one. But this particular bull has two copies of the same allele. He's homozygous, and you like that he'll pass on the same thing every time, but we can't really tell much about him from a marker standpoint. The same way with bull four. He's homozygous blue, but we can't tell a lot about him. But what we can discover, what we can evaluate is bull three. He's heterozygous. He has two different alleles. And so, on average, half of his progeny will receive the red allele, half will receive the blue. And through DNA technology, we can determine which are which. We look at the average of the reds versus average of the blues, more or less, and determine, are they different? If the reds out of three are different than the blues out of three, then there's a gene there doing that. And what it does then is what we're interested in. But we can't tell anything about one, two, or four because they pass on the same thing every time. That's a little different than what you're used to with the genetic tests that are currently being marketed. And these tests could potentially work to that stage, but I believe there may be even application before that. But this is the kind of markers we're dealing with, linked markers, where we have to evaluate each sire, and just because it works with a particular bull doesn't mean it works with every bull. And just because we say no effect on a bull doesn't mean there's no gene. It might mean he's just homozygous. So, with Dr. Tallman at the lead and lots of people involved, there was a cross-project evaluation of these 11 candidate genes identified at Texas A&M through checkoff research, and they were evaluated on basically all of the data that we had. At Texas A&M, they were identified as maybe having a primary trait that they were involved with, but we ran them across all traits because we wanted to see not only primary traits, but if there's been a lot of discussion here about alleles having multiple effects. Of the 11, five of them had highly significant effects on at least one carcass trait, or tenderness, shear force, taste panel type trait. And two of them had relatively significant effects as well. And so the people that I work with, we feel relatively confident that there's something there at those relative positions. That's 7 out of 11, and that's much better than I probably would have initially hoped for. The other four, the question about those is, are they real or not real? They might not be real. They might be false positives from the previous research. They might be unique alleles in the Angus or Brahman population that they were first discovered in. And then that's a possibility as well. We did not have a lot of American breeds in this study. Not very many American breeds, Brahman British or Brahman Continental cattle in the study. More of those might have been helpful in terms of determining those others, because those might be ones that some of them at least might have the unique alleles there. I'll talk in a little bit of detail about the ones that we did find. They're numbered in really no specific order. There's nothing magic about being 6 or 7. They're just kind of the way we started calling them. Kind of like the way line 1 started out as line 1, I think. QTL6 was one that showed highly significant effects for tenderness, both measured by mechanically with shear force and overall tenderness. It accounted for 12 and 13% of the phenotypic variation in tenderness. It seemed to be having what I term, at least, it's a judgment call, but I call that a large effect, or relatively. I think it's probably as large as we can hope for, in my opinion. It was also significant for ribeye area, accounting for less variation, but nonetheless statistically significant in having some effect there. And it's also encouraging that when that particular allele was studied at Texas A&M in the Brahman Angus population, it was also identified as having an effect on shear force and tenderness. So that's even more evidence that there's something happening at this location that could be meaningful. Of course, the obvious question is, how did shear force and tenderness relate to ribeye area? And in this particular case, of course, the same allele that made tenderness better did make shear force better. Those go together. In this case, the allele that improved shear force and tenderness actually made ribeye size decline slightly. Okay. QTL7 was having an effect more on weight traits, things in muscle traits, ribeye area and carcass weight, which logically go together, accounting for 7 and 6% of the variation, and also had a significant effect for juiciness, but highly significant on ribeye and carcass weight. QTL8, highly significant for carcass weight, and accounting for 10% of the variation in carcass weight. And again, that's exciting that a trait has that much, or a QTL, a gene somewhere in that region, is having that kind of effect. Having a number of other effects as well. In very few cases did we see allele that affected one trait that didn't affect something else within the carcass suite. Of course, some of these traits are related. The ribeye area is a muscle trait, and that drives carcass weight and some of those sort of things. But here we've got an allele that's affecting multiple things that, at least at first glance, don't seem to have a lot of biological relationship. Carcass weight, shear force, tenderness, ribeye area, and flavor were all impacted to some extent by the presence or absence, or excuse me, which form of the allele was present for this particular QTL. And this one I feel good about from the standpoint that the favorable effects all went together. In this particular case, the allele that increased carcass weight, I guess increasing carcass weight is good, to some extent. Doing that, that allele was the same one that improved tenderness, ribeye area increasing, and flavor increasing as well. So that's one that we didn't identify, that if you selected for one of those traits, that you'd get favorable results for all of them. 10 was highly significant for tenderness, accounting for less variation, but still a very consistent effect, and also having some effect on juiciness. 11 was highly significant for marbling, and accounted for 8% of the variation in marbling. Besides those five that had a highly significant effect, for the scientists, that's an effect, statistical significance of 0.01, or more significant than that. We also had a couple that we termed promising that were having significance at the 0.05 level, both of them affecting fat thickness. 4 was significant for fat thickness and accounts for 5% of the variation. 5 was significant for fat, accounting for 6%. 5 was also identified as a fat thickness allele, having an impact there in the previous study. So to me, that putting those studies together adds to the significance, and I feel more confident than I might have otherwise about that particular PPL. I kind of turned the table on its side to kind of look at it this way, that of those 7 that we see significance for, here's the traits they're affecting. That 6 is lighting up and seeming to have some effect. The yellow numbers are high significance, 0.01 significance. The white is somewhat less significance, but significant nonetheless. You can see 6 is affecting shear force tenderness and ribeye area. 8 is affecting the tenderness traits as well as ribeye area and flavor, some of those sort of things. And so it shows that, at least in this study, some of those genes are having the kind of pleiotropic or multiple trait effects that you're asking about and wondering about, and that's just within the carcass suite, that there are multiple trait effects. But there are some, again, that are simply seem to be affecting one and not the others. If you're particularly interested in this session, this section of my talk, and in this particular technology, Dr. Tallman is going to be speaking in the Emergency Technologies Committee this afternoon. His charge is to lead a discussion, go into more details about the statistical analysis and implications of some of this sort of thing. And so if you're interested here, rather than spend a lot of time here, make sure and hit that committee meeting, and Dr. Tallman will be able to provide you more details about it. There's also an economic portion. You may remember Dr. Steve Kutz's name from Colorado State University, an ag economist that was charged with looking at the economics of improving tenderness. And I'll summarize this in just a couple of slides. The final report has much more detail about the economic considerations that you might find very interesting. His observations were that in this study and in other data that he was able to access, that USDA quality grade does not adequately segregate steaks due to tenderness, and that's no surprise. That we know that while marbling is somewhat related to tenderness, it's not the only thing, and that we find both favorable and unfavorable steak for tenderness in most of our quality grades. I thought it was interesting to find that his thoughts that economic impacts of improving tenderness vary by grade. In other words, that the impact of improving tenderness impacts the lower grades more than the high grades. That, for example, he showed that if we were able as an industry to improve tenderness overall by 10%, that would drive the price of select beef up more than it would the price of prime beef, and even premium choice. Part of that is the idea that those higher grades already are meeting tenderness expectations at a greater level, at a greater frequency than the lower ones. But I think some of this, the impact is that, you know, those choice products and low choice products and select products become more desirable and get more result, more benefit from tenderness improvement maybe than some of the others. So the million-dollar question is, how do producers use this result? How can you take this back to your farms and ranches, your selection programs, and what's next? What's coming next that will impact the industry? How will this impact the future of breeding cattle? The obvious one is that if shear force EPD are part of the evaluation of bulls that you're interested in and breeds that you're interested in, those are readily available in those. And those are the easiest, quickest, and most efficient manner in the short term to evaluate tenderness and improve tenderness. Will the marker test become commercialized? That we have an arrangement as MMI was a partner in this project. They've invested a significant amount of funding, and they've worked with us a lot, provided us a lot of information and manpower. They have opportunities, and then other companies will have opportunities if they choose to commercialize this. These markers are not commercialized, they're not on the market at this point, but there's an opportunity for that company and ultimately any company to commercialize this information if they choose to do so. And then the the next question is, in what form would they be commercialized? Would they be in the type of test that you're familiar with, the direct test, the GeneStar, Tinder Gene, those type of identity kind of tests that do not require a progeny test prior to testing, or would they be in the linked marker form that we have today? If the technology were commercialized, that immediately sires could be evaluated with linked markers. Not with direct tests, but with linked markers. But not every animal would be able to. It wouldn't be a test that you could run across every animal you own. And some animals you own, many of them probably wouldn't be testable at all. But the legacy sires, the 70 sires in the project, most of them would be testable, not all for the same thing. They'd be testable for whatever they're heterozygous for. The way you'd use that test is that once that sire is established, if you have sons or daughters of that sire, you could determine which of those got his favorable tenderness or marbling or ribeye area allele and which got the unfavorable one. It doesn't change the individual. He's heterozygous and will always be heterozygous. But since he's throwing two different forms, you can detect which one got the favorable or unfavorable form. If you're interested in more animals beyond those 70 sires, which I certainly hope you are, then that requires a mini project, so to speak. Before you could apply the testing, we'd need to determine for any given bull that you're interested in, is he heterozygous, and for what is he heterozygous? So you need DNA on him, you need DNA on his progeny, and you need phenotypes. You'd need to measure them for whatever you're interested in and changing. If you're interested in tenderness, you would have to have some tenderness data. But there's more than tenderness effects up there. There are ribeye area effects, there are carcass weight effects, and those sort of things. And so that technology could perhaps improve what you're already doing with carcass EPDs for that particular approach. But you need to determine on those 50 progeny, their DNA analyzed to see, that would tell us which bulls are heterozygous and thus testable, and which traits, which PPL they're heterozygous and testable for. And then from then, any future progeny could be tested. You know, our structure is not ideal for this, the way it is for dairy. Well, not really dairy. The semen companies take the lead in this in dairy. And, of course, the corporate structure of the swine seed stock industry is perfect for this, and poultry as well. But I'm not convinced that the semen companies might not be the gatekeepers of this technology here, that they have a number of bulls they sell a lot of semen on. They progeny test those bulls already. Could this be added to it so that they could progeny test those most important bulls and with crossbred breeds that they handle, and release which tests are testable, and maybe even be the avenue for selling the tests? I think that's one model. I'm not sure that's the only model, and it may not be the best model, but I can see a model for application. I put this up just to remind you that there are effects we saw that are things that are already being measured. Sometimes people look at this and say, well, if I can't get tenderness data, then link markers aren't useful to me. But, in fact, there are significant effects for things that you're already routinely measuring in carcass data. And it's just a matter of DNA sampling and DNA analysis to add this to what you're already doing. There are some disadvantages. You would need some phenotypes. It's not the same as a direct test that you might be currently using or considering. Only progeny of heterozygous sires are testable. It will identify which progeny got the better or worse allele to you, but it will not tell you whether these young bulls or young heifers are homozygous or heterozygous. It won't cover the other side. It only covers the tested side, the sire side. Could these go on to direct tests? They could. They may. I hope they will. That there's something there. I'm convinced, and I think most of us who work on the project are very convinced, that in many of these locations there are real genes that are having effects, but we're not close enough yet to make them direct tests so that you can test every animal that you have. But with development, with significant amounts of time, significant amounts of cost, that they could take the next step. And we have data, and of course the original data might be part of that discovery process, and there's probably more data would need to be collected. But it's really the amount of time and cost is unknown. And it's a possibility. There are things there, and I think they will get there. It's impossible for me to say how much or how long. We could have taken the linked marker approach in short term, and then use the direct test when it becomes available. This is kind of one of those, what's he thinking with this slide? Barry Dunn talks about unintended consequences yesterday, and I enjoyed that part of it, and many of those were unfavorable. I was born during the time when Aldrin and Armstrong were en route to the moon, and when I was a little kid, I drank Tang, because the astronauts drank Tang, you know. Tang was not actually, we thought it was marketed as a byproduct of the space program that existed before then. But what was a byproduct of the space program is cordless drills. The very first cordless drill I read was used to take core samples on the moon. The extension cords weren't long enough, and they needed a cordless product to go from the Eagle to various spots on the moon, and they developed much of the technology we use in cordless razors, drills, phones, as part of the original Apollo mission. We have other benefits too. A smaller project, but nonetheless, I think, significant benefits. Cooperation among breed associations is something that we haven't always taken for granted, but this was an opportunity for breed associations to do so, and they very much did. And I appreciate the cooperative effort and spirit of breed associations, and I think it illustrates what can be done when we all work together. No doubt this project, along with the development and release of direct tests, has greatly heightened the awareness of marker-assisted selection and those sort of things. And I truly believe that this data set has forced the real advancement of the statistical procedures to analyze this particular information. To me, though, the greatest benefit, and one that we're already reaping the benefits from, is that we have something we didn't have. That we have, the industry has, a very large multi-breed database of DNA and phenotypes. And this project started before the first GeneStar marbling test was ever marketed, but yet this database, because of its creation, has been very important in evaluating those types of information. And I think we're very fortunate that the people, of course, before me, I was not an initial member of the team, but added on later, those people had the vision to collect that information and maybe saw this coming, or maybe were just lucky. But we now have and are using information that breeds have collected as part of the project. They have DNA samples with shear force measurements and carcass data so that we can validate genetic tests and potentially make further discovery and development. This is a very large population, much larger than any university experiment station could ever put together, and I think there's great opportunity for further discovery and development. And it's my opinion, at least, and I think most of us feel, that this may be the greatest discovery and greatest benefit of all, that this is a legacy data set that will, for many years, help the industry evaluate these tests and put them in the proper perspective and give us a chance to have an unbiased evaluation of the new technology. With that, if you could bring the lights up, I would like the members of the project